It's Season 2, Episode 9 of the Doctors and Litigation Podcast. I'm Gita Pensa. Welcome back. So I will tell you something. It is pretty hard to make the topic of malpractice insurance policies exciting for doctors or for other healthcare clinicians. Even if I tried to sell this as some sort of clickbaity, you'll be shocked to learn these 5 things about your malpractice insurance policy, I bet you probably still would not click. You would just scroll on by. So kudos to you if you clicked play and you're ready to learn a few things about your malpractice insurance policy. There are a few things in here that you might actually be shocked to learn. And you do need to know questions you should be asking about your coverage, preferably well before you ever need it. And there are things that you ought to think about when you're taking a new job, or if you are the person who is shopping around for insurance coverage for your group or for yourself. So, to talk about all these things and more, today I have a guest with a wealth of experience to help give us his perspective on things that you should know. Dr. John Schufelt, MD, JD, MBA, is a practicing physician and a practicing attorney, and he holds memberships in the Arizona State Bar, the Federal District Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court. He's also a highly successful entrepreneur who now writes about and teaches entrepreneurship to physicians, and I'll put a link to his website in the show notes if you'd like to learn about him. There's a lot to know, even though what I've already said sounds like a lot. He has definitely put all of those degrees to really good use. He's got a wealth of experience in clinical care, in the business side of medicine, and in the health law sector. And although I'm quite sure he could drill down into the minute details of any one of these topics, today we're just going to get a bird's eye view from him about what he feels clinicians ought to know about malpractice insurance policies and how they will affect what happens in your medical malpractice case. So, without the need for clickbait, without any further ado, let us get to some very helpful information that you need to be aware of from Dr. Schufelt. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast to clarify a lot of misconceptions and questions about malpractice insurance policies.
My pleasure. This is a subject that everybody needs to have their arms around because it's one of those things that ignorance is not bliss.
Yeah. And you have a great perspective on this. You teach this regularly. You're a physician and an attorney and also have an MBA. So you understand this from all sides.
I'm an inch deep and a mile wide.
All right. Well, let us talk about insurance. Thinking about insurance as a contract is, I think, a great place to start. And many people don't really see it as such because oftentimes they've never seen their contract. They don't remember signing anything in particular if they come in as, you know, an employee at a hospital or something like that. And they just have no idea what they're agreeing to or what is within the contract, what the insurance company is obligated to do. So in an insurance contract, basically, what are we agreeing to and what are they agreeing to in the agreement?
Well, one of the things that I think when you go and work for, like, for example, a large entity, a health system, a hospital, what have you, I think it's important that you get to see what your med-mal contract looks like, because there are some clauses in it that can and often do come back to bite people. So at least knowing what you're getting before you sign on the dotted line, your actual employment agreement, is probably worthwhile. But the main structures of a medical malpractice contract are things that people are familiar with. And those are the things that are the must-haves. What's the policy term? In other words, how long does it cover? Does it cover pre-existing claims? In other words, does it have nose coverage? Does it have tail coverage? What are the limits for that particular policy? What part do you have to pay, or does the system have to pay, and what part does the insurance pick up? So there's those clauses are the kind of key ones. And there's a number of other smaller clauses that are the gotcha clauses that it's worth talking about.
We'll get into that a little bit. If your policy, let's say you have coverage that says it's $1 million/$3 million, what does that mean?
Now, it can mean different things, but what it means is it's $1 million per claim or $3 million in aggregate for the year. And here's where the nuance is. That aggregate can mean your group. It can mean you as an individual. It can mean the entire emergency medicine department, the entire family practice department, knowing what that 3 million is, because if you're the 4th million of the 3 million, you could be bare. Now, if you're working for a hospital system, they're going to ultimately own it through this thing called respondeat superior. They'll own the liability. Still good to know.
So that will be spelled out somehow in your policy?
Well, it's a 1 million, 3 million. It'll be right up front, first paragraph of the policy. And then I suspect you're going to ask pretty soon, is it a claims made policy or an occurrence policy?
What is your advice for people? So I say often that I didn't know who my carrier was. I had no idea how I was insured when I was first named in a lawsuit. I didn't know who to call. A lot of times when I speak about this, I'll ask people, you know, raise your hand if you can name who your carrier is, and no hands go up. It's amazing. So this is a new concept for people to say, even if they're already working for a place, like, can I see the policy? Can I get a copy of the policy? And never, ever have I heard of anybody who is contemplating a job ask for the policy to weigh that in their decision of whether or not I work for this group. Never have I ever heard of that, but perhaps we can change that. So if you get a copy of this policy, you don't understand all the legal terms. Like, what would you advise someone to do to have that interpreted for them?
I think I'd first go back to your employer and say, here are my 10 questions on the policy. Can you answer them? And see what they say. Plus, you bind them, basically, if you get an email response from, you know, your chief medical officer, and she says, oh, here's what it means. Great. She's kind of obligated the company to those rules which they live by because you're relying on her as an authority. The other thing you can do is just go find a healthcare attorney and have them interpret or help you interpret the contract. But I do think it's a great idea, and I know that's what you just said, getting a copy of this contract. But also something you said, which was really interesting, is knowing who the carrier is and doing your homework. And this may be super nuanced, but different carriers treat different physicians differently. There are some carriers, like the carrier that I use here in Arizona, it's MICA. It's a physician mutual insurance company. They treat physicians incredibly well. Their CEO was a physician forever. Very in sync with physicians, but they're a rarity, I believe.
I've actually spoken with some people from MICA in the past, and I can tell you that I find that to be true. And so, yes, knowing what the structure of the company is, knowing whether you're, most people don't even know, am I insured? If I do work for a hospital, am I insured with the hospital? Do I have a separate insurance policy? So let's get into more about these things. So you mentioned claims made, occurrence based. Let us start with the basics of the type of policy. One of your questions is going to be, of those 10 questions, is this a claims made or occurrence based policy? What is the difference?
A claims made means that the claim happens while you are actually an insured person in that group. So let's just make it real easy. You're working in urgent care. You have a contract for a year. And if an event happens and the claim is made within that year, you're covered, hands down. What happens, however, if it's a minor and now all of a sudden they don't get into Harvard and they somehow think it's because of you. You screwed up their chance to get into Harvard. And 10 years later, they come after you. Now, you may have a tail policy on that thing, and that tail policy typically lasts 2 to 3 years, but now you're 10 years out. If it's a claims made policy, you're basically screwed. If it's an occurrence policy, if the claim happens, if the malpractice event occurs while you're under that policy, no matter when a claim is made, you're covered. Occurrence policies in this day and age are pretty rare. I haven't seen one in quite a while. Most policies are claims made.
Okay, just to summarize, the occurrence policy is like, as long as it occurred when you were working at this place and you were under this policy, then the claim will be covered in perpetuity.
No matter when they file, 20 years from now, 2+ the age of majority, you're good to go.
Okay. Claims made, it's going to be, if it happens while you're working there, great. But what you have to worry about is after the fact, once you leave that, do you have tail coverage? How long does that last? Tail coverage, you might have to purchase. If you're going to a new employer, you have to find out about what kind of coverage that has. If you have nose coverage, do you have to buy your tail coverage? Is your institution going to pay for tail coverage? All of these questions are questions that you want to ask.
And I've seen physicians held hostage by their insurance because the tail was not provided as part of their contract. So they say it's like Hotel California. You know, you can check out, but you can never leave. So they say, well, yeah, you can quit, go ahead. But, oh, by the way, you have this tail policy. And the tail policy is typically 150 to 300% of your last year's insurance, which is often your most expensive year. I mean, the longer you go, the more the insurance costs, up to about year three, and then it pretty much flattens out.
That's in their contract that they have to pay for that?
Well, I've seen a lot of contracts that are silent on it. Yeah, we'll cover your malpractice insurance. And then the physician or the provider does not know. They sign it, and then they want to leave, and they say, oh, well, what are you doing about your extended reporting endorsement? Because we're not paying for that. And all the provider has to make a decision. Do they fork out 3X, 2.5X their last year's coverage, or do they just keep on working there? Or when they get a new job, do they ask their new employer to have nose coverage? This prior acts is called. And the prior acts will do a thing for, it's really for all the sins of your past life sort of thing. It covers you forward, not backwards.
So just to get the language, the extended reporting endorsement is the tail coverage and the prior acts coverage is the nose coverage.
Correct.
All right. So we've covered that. That also is another reason, I suppose, why everybody should really understand their coverage before they sign on the dotted line to accept a job.
What are the limits of your nose coverage or extended reporting endorsement? Because they're not always the same.
That's a very good point. So again, if you're coming out of residency, you're getting a job, start thinking about these things, asking the questions, knowing what questions to ask, because historically no one has advised us in any way to ask these questions. And I honestly, even state by state, look into the malpractice climate in a given state. I mean, I don't know that I would have wound up in this state, but I live in a state where the malpractice climate is terrible, which I didn't know until I was knee deep in it. But if you have the liberty of working anywhere, then perhaps that's something that you want to include in your calculus. I got sucked into Rhode Island by family, but
yeah, that's absolutely true. And we've seen a rise in jury awards of late. And when I talked to both the plaintiff and defense attorneys, they say it's really been post-COVID and physicians were the frontline workers. We were this, we were that, and everybody was rah-rah. And after COVID, it's taken a turn for the worse. And now you're starting to see these really excessive malpractice judgments. So you may have a $1 million coverage, but if you have a $2 million claim, there's another $1 million to pay. And you've got to figure out where that money's coming from. And that's another part of the contract.
We're going to get into that in just 1 minute. But we talked about nose and tail coverage. What would you advise people to do in terms of keeping records to make sure that they can prove they don't have a gap in coverage at any point?
So that's a great point. And there are insurance carriers that if you have a gap in your coverage, they won't insure you. So let's give an example. You work for an urgent care. You have $1 million, $3 million policy. You leave that. You have a tail. The tail runs out after 2 years. Great. And now for whatever reason, family obligations, you want to travel, go back to school. There's a period of time when you're uninsured and then you go back and start working again. There's this window of coverage there. It's called a gap. And there are insurance plans, and this happened to Micah, I believe, where the judge said, yeah, I know you weren't the insurer, but someone's got to pay. It might as well be you. So there are insurance plans that if you have this gap in your coverage, that if it's not contiguous, they won't pick you up for fear that they're going to get tagged for something that A, they didn't get paid for, and B, you weren't one of their insureds when the event happened. So gaps in coverage are a big deal.
So you're going to want to keep the sheet that shows when your coverage dates are. You're going to need to keep all that information. And you may have to think about perhaps paying to extend your tail coverage or independently paying for insurance for a year or something like that, right?
Exactly. And you know, if your state has a 2-year statute of limitations, and what that means is there are 2 years after an event happened where the plaintiff knew or should have known that something untoward happened to them. Now, if they're minor, it's a different story, and there's some other caveats. But generally speaking, in most states, there's a 2 years, not more than 3-year statute of limitation. So if you go your 3 years unscathed, buying insurance as an extension of the extended reporting endorsement is pretty inexpensive, comparatively. And so what you're saying is dead true. It may be worth doing that if you're going to find yourself with a gap in coverage.
And so finding out what the statute of limitations is for certain things in your state is also a good idea and something that many people just don't know. Now, let us talk about deductibles. When people are purchasing, let's say they're independently practicing, which is more and more of a rarity, or you know, they're a small group is purchasing, thinking about the deductibles, how do they get applied?
Right. So something called an SIR. And so what that means is the insurance will kick in after a certain amount. And that certain amount can be as low as zero or as high as 100,000, meaning the physician or the client, maybe it's an urgent care group or the hospital, covers the first $100,000 of expenses. So in one of the emergency medicine groups that I'm involved with, we have an SIR of 50,000. We pay the first 50, and that usually goes to the defense law firm, and then the insurance policy kicks up after that. And the reason people do that is to lower their overall cost of insurance. So if you've got a great insurance track, a great Med-Mal track record, you may say, you know, I'm going to roll the dice a little bit, pay a lot less, but I'm up for the first 100,000 or first 50,000 in any claim. And again, that usually goes to pay your defense attorney.
What does SIR stand for?
Self-insured retention.
Also in the policy will probably be spelled out what types of actions a policy will cover. Other than just malpractice, might a policy cover things like board investigations?
So some policies do cover board investigations. And what they'll cover is, for example, one of our policies is the carrier will pay up to, I think it's $25,000 for defense costs in a board action. And they'll help you secure a insurance validated recommended defense attorney for this. And that's one of the things I used to do in my practice was defend physicians in front of the medical board. And so as part of your malpractice policy, they will cover board complaints. But you broach on something really important. When doesn't malpractice insurance cover you? And I can tell you how people get themselves in trouble. If you are practicing impaired, you may not be covered. If it's a sexual harassment claim, in other words, you're having inappropriate contact with a patient, you may not be covered. If you lie in your malpractice application, probably won't be covered. So there are things that are going to exclude you from coverage. If you falsify the medical record, a lot of times your insurance companies will say, that one's on you, and they don't cover you. So all big red flags of things to make sure you don't do if you expect your Med-Mal carrier to cover you.
Another thing I think, speaking of this being a contract that physicians often don't understand, is that as part of this contract, they are also beholden to the insurance company by something called a cooperation clause. So sometimes you hear about people saying, like, this case is baloney, they need to make this go away, I'm not going to answer my lawyer's calls, I'm not going to answer their emails, I'm not going to cooperate, I just want to tank this thing, I just want them to settle it, and I want to move on. They can deny your coverage for lack of cooperation, too.
Totally. Yeah. If you're not playing ball, absolutely. If you get named, you got to be all in, as painful as it is. And you've got to be all in on helping the defense team work to exonerate you from this claim.
Let us talk about some differences between self-insured hospital systems, where someone might have a policy that includes sort of a shared defense with the hospital and co-defendants that are also covered by that, and how that might differ from you and your independent group have a policy with some private insurance.
Yeah, private insurer. Here's where people can have a rude awakening. And I've been involved in a case where I was the attorney for this physician. Kid comes in with a rare form of meningitis, diagnosed as viral meningitis, looked like viral, smelled like viral. Kid got better in a few days, was discharged home. The pediatric hospitalist crushed it, did everything right. Unfortunately, the kid turns out to have Coxsackie meningitis, which was incredibly rare in infants, like nearly unheard of in infants. The kid a week later comes back in, has a poor outcome, and has a life care plan of $1 zillion. I mean, it's like $30 or $45 million life care plan. Even though the physician in question, the hospitalist, did everything right, and he had the literally world-renowned expert in coccidiomycosis as his defense expert, the hospital system said, I don't want to touch this one. We're going to settle for policy limits and we're going to get everybody out. Now, the physician's like, wait a minute, I didn't do anything wrong. And I said, hey, if you want to fight this on your own, go for it. And so what I've seen happen with these self-insured or large hospital systems is they will blanket settle, even though many of the providers are like, hey, I didn't do anything wrong. I was just the ER doc and I admitted the person 22 minutes after they showed up in the emergency department. Like, how am I responsible for this? I did everything right. And that is a downside.
Some people will see that as a real negative. They have to share the defense. So they may have an attorney that also has other co-defendants and is also representing the hospital, and sort of everybody has that shared boat. They'd sink or swim together. But what I've also seen in some of those cases is because the hospital has, like, it's all the same pot of money. So the hospital tries very hard to get the defendant physicians dropped and then settle it as the hospital themselves. that sometimes is an advantage. And so I think it's hard sometimes because there's definitely pros and cons for both of these, but everyone just needs to know what they're getting into. So when the hospital, you're all self-insured, you're all insured together. The pros that I can think of are situations like that where they really push hard to get the docs dropped because there's no advantage to the plaintiff's attorney to keep the docs in. It's all the same pot of money.
No, they just want the money.
They just want the money. So they're like, fine, I'll let them go. You give me the settlement for $5 million or whatever. We'll drop everybody who's named and the hospital's going to take that responsibility, which feels a little better for the doc, I guess. But I've seen that. And I've also seen the positive of co-defendants not feeling like they've got to stab each other in the back. And I've been in the scenario where I had, in my case, I at the time was covered by another private insurer. I wasn't covered in the same pot as my hospital system. And my hospital system sent me letters threatening to seek indemnification if there were a verdict in excess of policy limits from me and my group. And that's another thing that people don't know, I think, is with your contract as a group with the hospital, there is often a clause that says that the hospital can seek indemnification if you are lumped together in a lawsuit and you have different coverage, that if you go to trial and you lose, and the hospital sinks with you, that they can come back after you for the money. That's something I think a lot of people don't know. And it feels so dirty, but it's just kind of standard.
But, you know, from the hospital's perspective, if this is a pure physician error in the hospital just got dragged into because the person happened to be hospitalized there, you kind of see their point. Like, wait, why am I on your sinking ship? This is all useful. It's not very fun, but I do get their point.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's all business. It's just a shock to find out. You think, oh, your hospital, you know, has your back. And when you have separate insurance policies, that might come to pass. And so that's kind of an advantage of being insured with your hospital in one of these. But the downside is that you do have to share representation with other people. You probably don't have a lot of say in whether or not you're going to settle the case.
No, there's no consent clause generally.
Yeah. So you've got to weigh these things together. But again, knowing what you're getting into, I think going in eyes wide open is really important, and it will absolutely affect your experience of, you know, being totally shocked by the way these things evolve if you have no idea.
Let's talk about consent clauses. Consent clause just means that you have, generally speaking, the authority whether to settle or not as a physician of record, which is great because there are some insurance companies that would say, look, we're worried this is going to be excess. Yeah, sure, you believe you, but you know, our experts, not as much. So if you don't consent to settle, we're right there with you. We're fighting with you, which is great if you win. There are some policies that have what's called the hammer clause. Now, it's never spelled out, or they don't show you a picture of a hammer hitting you on the head, or they don't spell out the word hammer. But what the hammer clause is okay, you have consent rights, but if we suggest you settle for this amount and you refuse, and there's a verdict in excess of what we suggested you settle for, you own it. And so we could have gotten out of for $500,000. Now we have a $2 million verdict. That one point, yeah, you've got the consent, all you, brother, but that $1.5 million, it's coming out of your pocket, not ours. And those hammer clauses are there for a reason, and they're basically to hammer you into submission is how I look at it.
We all would like to say that we want to be able to make that decision. Do we settle the case? Do we not settle the case? Yeah, with the hammer clause, I don't know if you want as much control as you think you do. My lens is usually to tell the doctor to understand your policy. And the most important thing is really to figure out how to preserve your assets. Like, that's thing number one, is to not get really harmed by the way this goes. I mean, it's a rare event for those things to happen, but you need to understand when you sit down, what are my risks? Like, can you just real size these risks for me so that you can make decisions?
And frankly, we just had a case in our group, and I'm usually generally pretty good at, you know, getting a sense of the outcome. Totally wrong. Not only was I wrong in the outcome, I was definitely wrong in the damages. When I went back to the attorney, they kind of shrugged and said, yeah, post-COVID, we're seeing these excess verdicts. And we go back and poll the jurors. They said, well, yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe the doctor didn't do anything wrong, but we felt really bad for the plaintiff. Well, that's not how this is supposed to work. I mean, sometimes just bad stuff happens through no fault of anybody.
Which is why you want to make sure that should that happen, you want to be protected. So doing your level best to figure out how to navigate this. And it sounds like a lot and it sounds really scary. But first thing is just figuring out like the lay of the land. What does the policy say? What are my rights in this situation? What is our contractual agreement between you and the insurance company? What's my exposure here?
What we didn't talk about, which is probably maybe the most important thing, is do your best not to get sued. And how do you do that? You're kind to patients. You're an effective communicator. You sit down with them and you use shared decision-making and you document it. Patient was given informed consent, participated in shared decision-making. Mom agrees that CT scan of the child's head is not indicated at the present time. However, we'll look at X, Y, and Z and return immediately if that occurs. If you write that in the chart, it may not be 100% protective, but it looks really good when the kid comes back with an epidural hematoma that was missed 3 hours later, which is a case I had.
I mean, obviously, yes, prevention is worth so much more than an ounce. But once, you know, a lot of us are going to wind up in this situation, and knowing what to do or what to expect on the other side is so important. Okay, here's my last question for you. Under what circumstances might a doctor who is involved in a shared defense consider hiring their own counsel? I get this question all the time. Like, what are the upsides and downsides to having your own attorney in that scenario? Does it change whether the insurer will pay for a settlement or a judgment against you? What happens there?
I suspect the insurance company won't pay if you hire your own defense counsel. They won't pay for the defense counsel. That comes out of your pocket. And those are generally not small bills. They're relatively significant. I mean, $250 to $400 an hour sort of significant. I would have that discussion with my insurance company prospectively. If you don't think you're getting adequate representation or fair representation, it's a very smart thing to do to bring in your own representation, but just make sure you're not precluded from doing so. And I would be very careful to find an attorney who has worked with these other attorneys who are already on the case. So there is some collaborativeness and not combativeness out of the gate.
That's really good advice. Is there any role for just the way we do in medicine, asking for a second opinion? Can you hire someone to say, like, can I just spell this out for you? Does this seem fair to you? Does this seem like they're doing right by me?
Absolutely. I mean, in that you can easily do on your own and just basically present them the facts in the discussion and let them give you a sense of what this is. And generally speaking, they're probably going to say, yeah, maybe they could have done a little better here. But generally speaking, they're doing well by you. The other thing to do is find another expert to have them opine upon your case, because I've seen some experts who are just, I believe, way off the mark as far as what they believe the standard of care to be. Now, ultimately, it's a jury decision. But if you have an expert that is, oh, you've got this 100%. Yeah, no, you didn't do anything wrong at all. And you're kind of in the back of your mind going, oh, it's not quite true. I could have done a little better here or there. I could have documented better. You may want to find an expert that's a little maybe less biased or maybe has another perspective, because I mean, that's why there's experts on each side of the case. There's two different opinions. So clearly two very competent, well-reasoned people think the exact opposite about how something should have been played out. So it may be worth getting your own opinion on that as well.
That is interesting. That is the first time I've ever heard that recommended. And I think that's really interesting, like being able to hire them within that attorney-client bubble, talking to your attorney maybe about like, can we have another expert? But maybe you would have to pay for that too.
And that's probably inexpensive. I mean, one of your friends could even do it for you and say, look, just hit me right in the face with this. If I screw this one up, just tell me. But I need your opinion because I need to see how far I can push this. If you say, John, you crushed it, you hit the standard of care, and here's the data supports it, I'm in. As opposed to, John, you know, I see why you thought that way, probably kind of old thinking, and there's a better way to do it now. And consequently, I think you're behind the standard of care on this one.
What would you have to do to keep that conversation protected? What would mechanistically you have to do?
That's a really good question. That's a question for the attorney. And that's why you may want to do it through the attorney to make that privilege. Now, not all communication with the attorney is privileged in that regard. Some of it you have to share regardless, but that's a question because it's jurisdiction dependent.
John, you have given us a lot of stuff to think about. I think the bottom line for everybody is, please get a copy of your policy. Please understand your policy. I work with a lot of claims people. They're usually really happy to explain things. Nobody ever asks them. So they can come talk to your group. They can come, you know, just understand. I like the group setting a lot too. If you're in a hospital, someone at risk, whatever, ask them to come and talk and tell you and ask these questions. What happens in this scenario? What happens in that scenario? It's less intimidating for everybody. And it's a lot easier than finding out when you're sitting in the hot seat face to face with them and they're telling you about a claim. It's a lot better to know that going in, I think.
And the key is, no matter what, do not alter the medical record. If you do, your insurance company will be like, we're done because we're not covered anymore. This one's on you. If it happens, own it. You can type something after the fact because it's timestamped. It looks kind of defensive, but it's okay, as opposed to going in and erasing it and trying to do something else, because you always get caught.
I usually advise people, just don't even go in, man. Just don't touch it. Anything that you do in there, they're going to make it seem nefarious. Even if you don't mean it that way, just don't do it. Just leave it alone. And then you're going to get your chance to talk about what happened. They will find a way to use that against you. Don't touch it. That's usually what I tell.
Don't hire Michael Cohen.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to have you back at some point to spell out some of the other finer points, but I really appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thanks for doing this. This is very helpful.
Okay, everybody, that was a lot of information. If I can bottom line it for you, my takeaway is this: get a copy of your policy. Your policy is a contract between you and your insurer. Have someone who understands it interpret it for you. Could be someone in claims, someone in risk, or your own hired attorney if you're taking a new job. Ask all the questions about various scenarios, what you would have in terms of legal representation, what if there are co-defendants, who assumes the burden of any settlement or verdict in excess of policy limits. Sometimes there are various situations, various ways that that could play out, whether or not you have consent to settle, whether there's a hammer clause, what happens with your coverage when you leave, if you have a deductible, who owns the responsibility to pay that deductible, legal situations in which you would not have coverage. Ask all the questions. Know where you stand before you are ever in it. And it's always best to be informed and have your eyes wide open. I'll see you next time.